Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Well, today's the third Monday of the month, and this is the day where we explore business and how to create unique career lifestyles. Professor Doug Branson is my first guest today. He calls the CEO corporate suite the last male bastion, and we'll find out why in just a moment. He examines the gender issue in corporate America and why so few women become CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. He'll also take a look at what it takes to break that glass ceiling. Coming up at 12:35, Heidi Ganahl says, what glass ceiling? In our continuing series of The Real Story Behind Entrepreneurism, Ganahl shares her journey from wayward stray to top dog. And she certainly did have some personal struggles to overcome. Her company is now worth $40 million and, according to Entrepreneur Magazine, is one of the fastest growing companies in the U.S. It's also one of the, if not the largest, woman-owned franchise. And we'll end today's show by introducing a new monthly segment with our new resident guest, dream coach Joyce Chapman. We did a show some time ago with Joyce Chapman called Live Your Dream, and it remains today one of our most listened to podcasts. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Professor Douglas Branson to the show. He holds the W. Edward Sell Chair in Law at the University of Pittsburgh. He's currently a visiting professor at the University of Washington, as well as several other universities, both here in the U.S. and in, listen to this, New Zealand, Belgium, Ireland, France, Germany, Spain, South Africa, and England. I want his job. He holds a permanent appointment at the University of Melbourne in Australia, and he's the author of The Last Male Bastion, Gender and the CEO Suite in America's Public Companies. So welcome to the show, Doug, first of all.
Thank you.
And yes, you do like to travel by the sound of it. Tell us what a visiting professor does exactly.
A visiting professor escapes the politics and the committee work at his home institution or her home institution.
So I wonder why more people don't do that then.
They do quite a bit in law. It's a rather gypsy profession.
But. So you've written several books, the latest being The Last Male Bastion. And I want to begin by reading from the back of the book here. It says, the title of this book is a proper summation of its contents. While women have made great inroads in other areas of power and leadership, for instance, politics, they are still almost shut out of the boardroom of public companies in the United States. Those who do reach CEO status often find their tenure short and securing another position of equal authority very difficult. So let's begin taking a look at all of this. First of all, I wanted to look at the women's salaries. First of all, let's talk about the book and how you profiled this, because this was really interesting. You broke the book into three parts. You profiled 21 women who have worked for Fortune 500 companies. How did you select those women?
Those are the women who have achieved the CEO suite since the first Joe Barat at Mattel Toy in 1997. Before that, there were none. And since the book went to the printers, there's one additional one, Ursula Burns, who's also African-American, who's become the CEO of Xerox. But she replaced another woman, Anne Mulcahy. So the number of women CEOs has stayed level at 15. But there were none in 1997.
That's quite amazing. And what interested you in looking into this and seeing how far we had or hadn't come?
Well, I just come back from Australia, where we interviewed 14 women directors and several male company chairs. And it was interesting. All of the males said, I have daughters. And that's my case, too. I have two daughters who aren't in business but are ancillary to business. And so that was part of the impetus. Another part was some of the elites in academia were going around saying that the United States had achieved perfection in corporate governance. People from Harvard, people from Yale. This was around 2000. Mm-hmm. I looked around and saw there's a lot wrong with American corporate governance. And of course, as soon as these people wrote, Enron, WorldCom, Adelphia Communications, other imbroglios took place. So I picked this topic, and I've been working on it for about 7 years.
Yeah, it was really interesting and quite eye-opening. I wanted to look at, you list the top five female earners, and then you compare those with the top five male earners. And I want to let our listeners know this. The top five female earners earn between $8.69 million and $15.74 million a year. Now, that doesn't sound bad until you look at the top five males. They earn between $98.6 million and $192 million.
That's a so-so year, too. I mean, I also point out in the text that Larry Ellison at Oracle made $725 million yep. 1 year. Steven Jobs at Apple makes $500 million a year, year in and year out. And he still had to have his options backdated to make a little more. Michael Eisner, when he was the CEO at Disney, made $585 million. So that was a so-so year. I think that was 2007 those numbers were from.
So why are those numbers so disparate between male and female?
Well, there's a book by a woman at Carnegie Mellon, also in Pittsburgh, that says women simply don't ask. And there may be some truth to that. I think there's also some truth that women who are attempting to achieve entry into the CEO suite, and when they get that plum, they relax. They think, I've gotten there. I've achieved it. Whereas males, I'm just another male, and the mark is not just achieving the CEO suite, but maxing out in salary.
Yeah, and Meg Whitman, who was with eBay, was the highest female earner. You said she's the only one who really came close to falling into the male category.
Yes. Yeah. Now, I also have to say, this is the last, before the economic meltdown, 2007, the male compensation pales by the compensation of hedge fund managers. Five hedge fund managers made over $1.5 billion in 2007. And one of those was George Soros, who's, of course, quite well known.
Okay. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I'd like to take a look at some of the profile of these women because it was really quite fascinating. I loved in particular the lady who went to Mattel and brought the Barbie doll back to life. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Douglas Branson. His book is called The Last Male Bastion. Please stay with us.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, former editor-in-chief of Shape Magazine, tells how she went from being a highly successful businesswoman living her dream to losing it all and living her worst nightmare, a Bernie Madoff victim. Alexandra Penny recounts her struggle to overcome complete financial collapse. Now back on top, she'll share her journey in the Bag Lady Papers, the priceless experience of losing it all. See conversationslive.net for more information.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Some people know a good thing when they hear it. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
This is a man's world, but it wouldn't be nothing, nothing without a woman or a girl.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Professor Douglas Branson. He is visiting right now at the University of Washington, and he's written a really interesting book called The Last Male Bastion, Gender and the CEO Suite in America's Public Companies. I wanted to take a look, Doug, at some of the commonalities of these women. I wonder if, first of all, you profiled 21 women. Did you have a favorite? And I'm not talking necessarily personality, but as far as leadership style and business behavior.
I don't think I really had a favorite, but one of the people who captured me was Marion Sandler, who was one of the very first. She was a pioneer, and she and her husband built up Golden West Financial to be the second largest thrift institution in the United States behind a Washington Mutual, which is no more, as we know. But she went to NYU Graduate School of Business, and she wanted to become a partner at a New York investment house, and they told her women don't become partners in this firm. And so she and her husband set out, I think it was in the 1960s, and she built up this company, which they ultimately sold for $27 billion.
Ah, it's pretty impressive. I said before the break, or maybe it was during the commercial, that one of my favorites was the lady who headed Mattel for a while. She went in with no experience. Tell us a little bit about her journey.
Well, Jill Barad showed up for work in purple cowboy boots and a purple miniskirt. And she very quickly became the director of Barbie, which principally was a marketing job. And while she was there, the average girl, there being Mattel toy, went from owning one Barbie to nine Barbies with all of the different accessories that go with that. Mm-hmm. But there's a valuable lesson to be learned from that, because when she was ousted as CEO, we basically have never heard from her again. And I think her experience was very lopsided, and that's a lesson. You can't have a lopsided basket of skills you bring. She was only and primarily a marketing person. And you have to have a specialty, but you have to have the other skills. You have to have some financial background and familiarity, and you have to know a little bit about operations. And if manufacturing's involved, you got to know about that. Mm-hmm. You can't be lopsided, and that was the takeaway from her story.
Right.
That she was lopsided.
Interesting thing with Jill was that her first two projects that she did for Mattel actually failed. But she kept pushing and kept pushing, and finally went to the CEO and said, I want your job. Yes. Tell us how that went.
Well, she ultimately, she got the job. I mean, he said, you know, no or hell no. And but then he called her back a few weeks later and said, I've thought about it. And you know what? You're right. And and she got the job. But another lesson we take from her experience and the experience of several of these other women is when women make the CEO suite and then fall from grace, we almost never hear from them again. When males get demoted or get booted out of a high managerial office, it seems like a few years later they're back again.
Yeah.
They're like football coaches or baseball managers, you know. They just never quite die. And I call that the rubber floor. And women, I think it is because they don't have a very big support group up there at the top. So there's nobody to prop them up when they start falling, and they fall completely from grace.
Mm. You said in a couple of these incidences, even though boards were publicly supporting the female CEO, privately many of them were actually waiting for them to fail and made the comment that they were giving them twice as long as they would give a male. That's not equality, right? That's not the equality we seek, I don't think.
Well, there's some British academicians that have a theory. They call that the glass cliff theory, that boards are most likely to give the CEO job to a woman when the corporation is in difficulty, because the attitude is, well, we've tried everything else, let's try a woman. And so, and I find that true. In about half of these situations, when these women became CEOs, the companies of which they became CEOs were in trouble. They were in extremist situations. So that's called the glass cliff theory.
Oh, interesting. I've not heard that before. You know, for all our self-proclaimed leadership in the U.S., I was staggered by some of the statistics in your book. And we fall behind many Western countries as far as women in leadership. In the Nordic and Scandinavian countries, for example, between 40 and 47% of government is female. In the U.S., only 17% of our senators are female. Why do you think we're still so top-heavy?
Well, one of the participants in this exercise I went through in Australia is Norwegian, and she was just saying that equality is embedded in the social fabric in Scandinavian countries, and it's not in our country. We pale even by comparison to places like Costa Rica, where 43% of the legislators are women. We don't have this social fabric that has embedded in it the notion of equality between the sexes.
Mm, interesting. Another of the women that you profiled was Carlton Fiorina, who was at Hewlett-Packard. And funnily enough, I heard her on the radio today because you just made, you know, said they disappear and we never hear from them. Tell us about her story. What went wrong for her? Because she was the golden child at one time.
Well, she's running for the Senate. She's the Republican candidate for the Senate in California. Carlton Fiorina is an egomaniac. She's a very bright woman. She was the most powerful woman in America when she became the CEO of Hewlett-Packard, which, as I recall, was the 17th largest company in the United States. She lasted for 6 years, but a lot of the employees just hated her. They detested her. They had a couple workaday corporate jets, which would ferry people between Boise and Corvallis and the Bay Area. She got rid of them, and she bought a Gulfstream 5, which was for her use.
Mm-hmm.
And one time she circled the globe, I think, twice in 1 week. Her first year as CEO, she was on 54 magazine covers. Her denouement came when the board wanted her to have a chief operating officer, a number two. I've never seen a corporation that didn't have a team at the top,
right.
A CEO and a COO and maybe the CFO. And she refused to do that. She surrounded herself with young people who were yes people. And they said, over a long period of time, we want you to get a number two. You're very good projecting an image externally, but we need better management internally. And she refused to do that. And so she's a great self-promoter. So maybe she'll make a great senatorial candidate. Of course, it's a sad commentary on a society that
it is. It is. Of all the women, was the one who made mistakes. Obviously, we all make mistakes in our work, but is the one that really sticks out in your mind?
No, I don't think so. I think that by and large, other than the Carlton Fiorina example, these women have done a heck of a job. I mean, Pat Russo came into Lucent. Lucent was a failing company. She didn't rescue it, but, you know, she kept its head above water, and it merged with Alcatel and moved to France. Anne Mulcahy rescued Xerox. Xerox went from 94% of the market to 13%. Remember, when I was young, everything was Xerox copiers, and they fell out on that. And she got Xerox back to profitability. She kept its head above water. She reduced expenses. She moved the corporate headquarters to Norwalk, Connecticut, which is kind of an out-of-the-way town. She did a lot of things. So I can't think of, other than Carlton Fiorina and Jill Barad, of any of them have really fallen on their face.
Yeah. So why do you think we still have so few women in the corporate suite at the CEO level and Fortune 500 level?
I don't think it's blatant sexism. I have a chapter in this book, Go Where They Aren't.
Mm-hmm.
A number of these women CEOs have succeeded in businesses that were completely dominated by males 30 years ago. Paula Rossport Reynolds, who headed up Safeco Insurance here in Seattle, made her way in the utilities industry. Pat Wirtz at Archer Daniels Midland, She grew up in the oil and gas industry. Ellen Coleman became the CEO of DuPont, Paint and Chemicals. Lynn Elsenhaus, CEO of Sunoco, oil and gas. So it's not blatant sexism. It's more subtle than that. You know, as a father of daughters, you see it beginning in middle school when mm-hmm. they don't do well or think they can't do well in mathematics. I used to try and get my daughters to take at least economics and a course in managerial accounting. They say, Dad, that was a great idea, but they didn't do it. And later you see it surface when these women don't have the financial grounding that they should have to rise to the highest levels in the management suite. These 21 women, many of them do, but the women who make it just to a level one or two below that, they don't. And mm-hmm. so it prevents them from having the overall basket of skills they need.
Right. You put in the book 10 tentative teachings made final. You looked at some ways that women can make sure they're on that track.
Boy, you really did read this thing, didn't
you? I told you I did. It was really interesting. First of all, one we might expect, develop a can-do attitude, a can-do reputation. This one kind of, I guess it didn't surprise me too much, but we're often told, you know, be the red poppy in a field full of yellow poppies. Stand tall. You say, don't too much a tall poppy be. Talk about that a little, if you would.
That's I associate that with Australia. That's an Australian expression. And women who are too flamboyant, that's, again, Joel Barad and Carlton Fiorina, among others. They get cut down. And the emphasis today in many businesses is the team production idea. So that if you set out or hold yourself out as doing it alone, you're setting yourself up for a fall. And I think that's especially true for women.
Mm. And you've talked about this, prepare yourself for the financial and accounting side of business. This is a huge thing. So from what we've been talking about, women really need to get a broader scope of background, correct?
Correct.
In general.
I have 21 women in this book, 16 of them have MBAs. And the saw you hear is education doesn't matter after your first job. Paul O'Neill, CEO of Alcoa, went to Fresno State part-time. Paul Gates dropped out of college, albeit Harvard. But these women, they're different. And for women, education does matter. And it's particularly education in business and financial matters. A number of things that are counterintuitively in my book. People say women who want to really advance should have no children or limit themselves to one child. 20 of 21 of these women have children, and mm-hmm. the total is 43 children.
Wow.
and a couple of these women said, as I reached toward the top, I needed my family more than my family needed me. I needed somebody who would give me unconditional love and give me a little flack once in a while, too. Someone with whom I could come home and there would be a complete different outlook than what I got at the office. You know, no business, baseball games, ballet, meals, soccer games, that kind of thing.
Yeah, just get their head out of that boardroom mentality there. Changing careers often aids career advancement, you say. I read somewhere a long time ago where they did a study of women. They said women tend to stay too long in one company. So I'm assuming you would agree with that based on your findings, maybe?
Well, I have an earlier book called No Seat at the Table by NYU Press about the lack of women directors. And I find that a lot of women start out in business, they step out of business, they go into government, not-for-profits, NGOs, academe especially. And then when they rise much more quickly than they would in business, they sidestep back onto corporate boards. I find that women who go to the CEO suite, the career pattern is a little different, but they do sidestep from businesses to businesses. But generally, they do stay in the business sector. Many of these women had 3 and 4 jobs. I think Meg Whitman takes the cake, and she must have had more than a dozen positions as she mm-hmm. rose up through the ranks. That would be excessive. But A lot of these women have changed jobs several times, and maybe once or twice in a career they've even changed sectors. They've gone, say, from oil and gas to utilities or something of that nature.
Yeah. One of the criticisms I heard about Meg Whitman when she was with eBay and she was actually planning her exit strategy. One of the criticisms I heard about her, I think it was on 60 Minutes, was that she had been too strategic for Meg Whitman. She was more about Meg Whitman than eBay. Would you agree with that? Or
absolutely. Meg Whitman is the Republican candidate for governor in California for 2010. And most particularly, I point out, and it hasn't been pointed out at all, that Meg Whitman received over 100 allocations in what we call hot initial public offerings. And she was sued, and she paid several million dollars in settlement of that lawsuit. She was the poster child for this practice, which is known as spinning. It's never been brought to light. Either she has a blind spot, a moral blind spot, that's evidenced by her receipt of those profits, or she has a further moral spot because there seems to have been some kind of cover-up of this. It's never been brought to light, and I don't know precisely why.
Interesting. One of the teachings in your book is you can't let the snowball roll over you. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's from Pat Russo. She went through a parade of horribles at Lucent. They laid off 120,000 workers, I think was the total they came to at the end. She had quarter after quarter of red ink. But unlike Carlton Fiorina and some of the others, she never made rosy predictions. She said, you know, times are tough and it's not going to be good. And in another quarter, it's not going to be good. But she never let it get her completely down. She came back, for lack of a better expression, to fight another day. And she kept doing that and doing that over a number of years.
Right. A segment you have called Teachings for Everyone. We talked about this a little. Keep your ego in check and learn to partner. Do you think men typically partner better than women because of the team sports? Although women are into team sports these days at school.
One of the advice books, I read all the advice books for women, and many of them I think are wrong. They counsel assertiveness, aggressiveness. That might have worked 30 years ago. It doesn't work today. One of these books in particular talks about the sports metaphor, that men grow up playing team sports and women do not. That's absolutely false. I mean, both of my daughters played competitive sports and at a pretty high level. And so I don't think it's that.
Okay. And three paradigms. I want to just try and get those in before we end here very quickly. The tightrope paradigm. Sum up that for us, if you would, because this is in your conclusion.
Well, I haven't fleshed this out completely, but it's much more difficult for a woman. A man could come into a workplace and be aggressive, assertiveness. The metaphor is, in some companies, they identify up-and-comers and they say, he's the quarterback type. For women, if they were aggressive or assertive far past their first promotion, they'd be sidetracked. They have to demonstrate more than men, I think, at an early stage diplomatic skills. They have to back off the aggressiveness. And then as they reach toward the top, they become aggressive and assertive again, but more strategically, not across the board. And it's just a labyrinth. You have a woman who wants to rise in a corporate setting has to go through about four or five different paradigms, where a male, one or maybe two.
Interesting. That is really interesting. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, the United States is far behind. I mean, this conference I just attended or spoke at in Australia, we had representatives from Norway, which passed a law, and 40% of the directors of public companies must be women. I'm not advocating a law, but this is a hot subject in Europe. Spain, the Netherlands, France have laws. It's a hot subject in Australia and New Zealand. Here, it's not moved onto the back burner, but it's kind of like if I can invent an expression, it's on the side burner. And a lot of people attribute that to what was called diversity fatigue, that not only for promotion of people of different sexes, but people of color, people of different socioeconomic backgrounds, there's been so much emphasis for so long in this country that the people at the top are taking a breather. But I think the pressure has to be kept on, not, again, not through a law, not through quotas, but certainly keeping track. You know, you manage what you measure, and we have to keep our eye on the progress of women and other minorities toward the upper echelons of our business, because let's face it, we're becoming a much more diverse world and right. a much more diverse society.
Right. Well, Professor Douglas Branson, I thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Vicky.
And if you fancy yourself on the CEO track and want to know what's really happening out there, then this is the book that's going to really shed some light on things. It's called The Last Male Bastion, Gender and the CEO Suite in America's Public Companies. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. When we come back, we'll be talking with Heidi Ganahl.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals and paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
If you like to read fiction, check out Book Talk Podcast Reviews, brought to you weekly by Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Go to conversationslive.net and click on the menu at Book Talk to hear reviews of an eclectic range of books. We review fiction from chick lit and mystery to suspense and literary, from new to old, overlooked and forgotten. Check out Book Talk Podcasts today at conversationslive.net. If you'd like to suggest a book for review, email info@conversationslive.net or call 206-414-6159.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick and Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicky St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicky asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Following the herd is fine until they lead you off a cliff. Think for yourself. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
When another world take over, 'cause if you don't, the world will come to an end. It won't take long.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. In our first segment, we were talking about women CEOs and how some of them got there, what's holding others back, and their glass ceiling. My next guest says, what glass ceiling? In our continuing series of The Real Story Behind Entrepreneurism, we're profiling today Heidi Ganahl. She shares her journey from wayward stray to top dog. And as I said at the beginning of the hour, she certainly had some very personal struggles to overcome. But her story is quite amazing. She's triumphed over adversity to start the largest dog care franchise business in America. From the first camp, which opened in Denver, to now now a $40 million business with more than 250 franchises, with over 100 open camps in 39 states and Canada. Heidi Ganahl, welcome.
Thank you, Vicky. Thank you for having me.
And I'm sure I'm probably saying your name wrong, so tell us how you say your last name.
No, you're doing great. It's Ganahl.
Okay. All right, and you've written a book called Tales from the Bark Side, My Journey from Wayward Stray to Top Dog. And it was a very moving story, your intro to how you got to where you are today. And I wonder if you'd share some of that with our listeners today, because it really does epitomize how you can overcome even the worst of adversities. You were, 27 years old, I think, when your husband was killed in a small plane crash.
Yes, it was actually a gift from our family. One of our good family friends was a United Airlines pilot and did air shows with one of the old 43 Stearman, and decided for Brian's birthday to take him up as a surprise. My parents were watching. It was pretty tragic, and obviously my life changed dramatically at that point. But Brian and I, my husband and I, had written a business plan a few years before that, or about 2 years before that, around creating a better place for dogs. We had three big dogs and had abused our family and friends to the point that they were like, you have to find another option to take care of your animals because you guys are so busy. So we decided that the idea of socializing the dogs would be a great one, and that they could have as much fun as we did when we were traveling and on our vacation. We wrote the business plan for Camp Bow Wow, and we were looking for our first location when he passed away. So the business plan was shelved for several years after that, until my brother came along in 2000 and said, time to pick yourself up off the floor and get life going again. So we started the first one at that point.
Yeah, and you say wayward stray because you after losing your husband, which is perfectly natural, you went through a period of not knowing where you were and what you wanted to do, and suddenly turning this around to starting your own business. So tell us how you got, I read that you lost $1 million settlement.
Yes. I managed to blow $1 million by loaning money to family and friends and making some investments based on, you know, a high tutored investment advisor's advice, and which doesn't always work out for the best. And so I had about $80,000 left, and in the meantime had remarried quickly on the rebound and had a child and divorced quickly and had gone through a pretty hard custody battle with his mother. And so I was basically a single mom with $80,000 in the bank, working full-time in pharmaceutical sales, and really just very discouraged because I had always wanted to be an entrepreneur and make big things out of my life. And I wanted to set a good example for my daughter and really show her that, you know what, you can pick yourself up, you can get things rallied and move past things like that in your life and make it worthwhile.
Yeah, and I have to commend you for being so honest in the book, because I think people do learn from other people's, difficulties. But you also believe, you stress when you give talks around the country, you stress the importance of embracing your own story, that the all-American lifestyle is not about having a perfectly smooth existence. It's about adapting and creating a wonderful life out of the struggles that you have.
That's right. All of us have our struggles, and all of us are handed challenges in our life, and it's really in how you react to them and how you respond and create goodness out of whatever happens, no matter how horrible it is. And I think that especially in this day and age, with the struggles that folks are going through financially and with the economy and just the general strife around the world, it's really important to look at the positives in your life and figure out how to spend every day doing something that you love. And that old adage, do what you love and the money will follow, it really is true. And it takes a while. It takes a lot of struggle. But if you can find it within yourself and spend days doing something that you're very passionate about, it can change your life.
Right. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. I want to just look at how you got your first camp off the ground. How you took the plans that you and your husband had developed and just revamped them. Is that what you did?
I did. I basically took my ideas about what I thought my dogs would really enjoy and talked to a lot of my friends and family about what they thought their dogs would enjoy, what kind of atmosphere. And rather than the old, dirty, traditional kennels that had the runs with the dogs barking and never getting to, you know, get out of that run the whole time their folks were gone, we decided to create a fun camp for dogs where they could play and socialize, and you could watch them on the webcams, which has been a big part of our model, so that people don't just hear from the employees that the dogs had a great time. They can log on, and their family and friends can log on and see the dogs actually enjoying themselves.
And it does look fun. And I told you before we started, I'm very disappointed you don't have one in Washington, because I'm actually looking for somewhere to board my dog right now. So you have this camp, and you're developing your own business. Where did the idea to franchise come from?
Well, it really came out of the phone calls from all the clients and people that heard about us wanting to do their own and saying, how can I do that? I want to spend my day hanging out with dogs. And, you know, I obviously told them it's a little bit more than that. It's running a business and dealing with the money and the financial parts and the management of employees and cleaning, lots and lots of cleaning with that many dogs in a facility. But it is great fun. And I wanted to share that experience with other people and help other dog lovers their own dreams come true too, and franchising was a great model for that.
Mm. You attribute in the book a lot of your success to the fact that you stuck to your strengths and you delegated everything else. So tell us what your strengths are.
Well, I believe that my strength played into franchising perfectly. It's really about vision and strategic planning and having a very clear idea about what the brand should represent and how to take incredible care of these furry friends. And if we do that, then the human friends will like that too and bring them back often. Mm-hmm. And really create an all one-stop place for dogs and for their parents. So having that vision and being really tried and true and bent on creating it and seeing it through was really important for the franchise model. I'm not so great at the day-to-day operations and managing the staff and the books, et cetera. And that's where the franchisees have talents that I may not have in running the day-to-day operations and loving that part of the business. So it works out really well.
Mm. Now, lest people think, you know, everything went gloriously well, you did have challenges in the beginning. For example, one of your partner, your friend, actually embezzled money from you in the beginning, way back when. How difficult was it to overcome that and build trust with people again?
That was heartbreaking. You trust people so much that you've known for that long. I'd known her for 15 years. She was actually married to my first husband's best friend and had worked in franchising, so I thought it was a great fit. And as I went through the struggles of the custody battle and some other things that were going on, she said, you know, don't worry about it. Let me take care of the books. Let me take care of the business side of things. And I've learned to not be as trusting and to really keep your books and that part of the business, the cash flow management, very near and dear to your heart. Don't trust it to consultants or let other people write checks. It's a story that you hear a lot from other business owners. And so I think it's a huge lesson. And no matter how well you know somebody, when money enters the picture, it becomes a very different game.
It does. It does. So let's go back to the comment you made earlier, because we hear this a lot and, you know, there's a lot of truth in it. Do what you love and the money will follow. But you say in the book, because the book is also a business guide too, lessons learned, and you use the metaphor of dogs sticking with your pack and all that kind of stuff. But you say that it's not enough just to have passion for a business, especially a business like this. You know, people who think, you know, I want to spend all my day with dogs, which sometimes I think. it's not quite that easy. There's a lot more to it. So tell us a little bit about what are the skills people need to have up front before they even start beginning a business.
I think the most important thing is dedication. You're going to eat, live, and breathe your business for many years. And you have to understand that regardless of getting rid of the corporate handcuffs or working 8 to 5 every day, you're putting on a new set of handcuffs, which are you're tied to your business all the time. And that's why it's important to do something that you're really passionate about, because if you're going to do it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, it's pretty important to like what you do.
Right. You have we've all heard that, feel the fear. Feel the fear and do it anyway. You say feel the fur and do it anyway.
Yeah.
What if you have a great concept and you're not the one who you don't think you can bring it to life yourself?
I think that there's definitely ways that you can still see the business come to fruition. There's a lot of people that have the energy and the wherewithal to start a business. And obviously, business partnerships are very difficult to manage and not always, they don't always work out ideally. But if you can find someone like that and you have the idea and the vision for it and you have someone to execute on that idea, it usually works out well because you have kind of a complementary set of talents. The other thing that you can do is go to your local business school and your MBA programs. Those kids have so much energy and so much life in them and want to do all these wonderful creative things, and that might just be the best way to tap into some folks that don't require a lot of money or control but want to help you build your business.
Mm-hmm. So you were a single mom when you did this. You took your last $80,000. What kind of courage did that take to take that leap?
At that point, it was really about making good on my commitment to buy into our commitment to each other, that we were going to make our life one of adventures and really giving it 100% and giving back to, at this point, it was the dogs. We were always big believers in giving back karma-wise and giving back
right.
business-wise. But it just felt like I was absolutely destined to do this. And the dogs would look up at me like, come on, you got to get your life together. We're here. We're going to help you. I know that sounds silly, but in the end, they're the ones that pushed me to do it. And my daughter, and knowing that mm-hmm. I wanted to set a good example for her. And I really had to dig deep within and come up with, you know, the energy and the courage to look beyond everything I'd been through and roll the dice and bet on my own abilities and my own spirit.
And now it's a $40 million business. I mean, that must make you feel like you're walking on cloud nine, I would think.
When I have time to think about it, yes. But that's not very often. But it is a lot of fun to know that really we've changed the way people take care of their dogs in this country. That's the thing I'm most proud about, is that there's, you know, a few thousand dogs a day that aren't sitting at home alone waiting for their owners or staying in a little box at a kennel
right.
when their owners are on vacation. And that's heartwarming and great. And it's great to know that we have our Bow Wow Buddies Foundation, too, which is our 501c3, and we can give back to those guys, too.
Yeah. The book is called Tales from the Bark Side, My Journey from Wayward Stray to Top Dog. It features 10 critical lessons to building a successful business. What would you say is the... If you could just give one of those, what is the most critical in your mind?
The most critical lesson, and it's very relevant right now, is understanding financial statements and knowing how to manage cash flow. And it sounds pretty simple up front, but it's very complicated, and I would absolutely encourage someone to buy just a couple books on cash flow management before they start a business, and understanding how important it is to have enough cash to get that business going and keep it going for the first year or two. Everything takes three times as long as you think it's going to. So.
Right. And you've been on this journey, what, 10 years now? Is that
yeah.
10 years? What do you know now that you wish you'd known when you first started out, Heidi?
I think I've learned that I need to trust my instincts and trust my gut. And no matter how much you pay a high-tutin consultant or you know, how much you learn at an MBA program, or from other people in the same industry, nobody knows your business better than you, and nobody knows what's right for your business better than you. And really trust yourself and trust your instincts, and you'll be right most of the time.
Right. Well, this has been called the doggone must-have book to start a business. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Heidi?
I just encourage people to really explore the idea of opening a business and working for themselves and being responsible for their own success and their own future. It's a wonderful, wonderful, difficult, very, very difficult thing to do, but it's so rewarding, and there isn't a better way to spend your days than jumping out of bed knowing that you're responsible for your own destiny.
That's very true. And you have a couple of different websites. Would you give those out? Because I'm sure that our dog lovers at least would like to take a look at the Camp
Bow
Wow. Sure,
we need some folks to open some camps in the Seattle area.
Yes,
we've got
please.
One coming the next year, but... we'd love to have more. So you can go to campbowwow.com, or my book website is heidi-inc.com. So heidi-inc.com.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And everyone have a doggone great day.
There we go. We will. And the book again, Tales from the Bark Side, My Journey from Wayward Stray to Top Dog, and my guest, Heidi Gunnall. And interesting book, interesting story, and some good business tips in there. All right. So next we are joined by Joyce Chapman. She is going to be our resident guest coming up on the third Monday of the month. She's going to have a short segment each month, a coaching segment. So let's introduce her. All right, Joyce Chapman, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Are you there? Yes.
I'm here.
I thought you went there for a moment.
I'm here.
And how are you today?
I'm really good.
So we're just telling our listeners we're going to introduce a new segment to the show. It'll be a short segment where we look at dream coaching. You are a dream coach. I've worked with a lot of coaches over the year, both professionally and personally, from business perspective and again personally. And I asked Joyce to join us because I believe she's one of the best in her field at what she does. She has a lifetime background in education. She has an uncanny intuitive sense of hearing not just what you say, but reading between the lines at what you're not saying. And sometimes that's more critical than hearing what you're actually saying. And she's a straight shooter. She tells you as it is, but she's also very creative and playful. So, and the Live Your Dream show that we did, Joyce, with you about 2 years ago, I think now, is still one of our most listened to podcasts. And you're going to join us for a short coaching segment every third Monday. So let's get started and let's talk about that a little bit.
Okay.
So tell us what's going to be going on.
Well, what I would love to have is to have people call in and ask me questions. And then we'll, you know, discuss them and ask me some more questions. One of the things that I know I'm very good at and I love to do is to assist people to truly live their dream, claim it and live it.
Right. And we're actually going to be ask listeners to email in or leave a voicemail message. So it won't be live, but it will be, you'll have the opportunity of, if you're in a place where you feel stuck or you feel something's holding you back or there's some kind of block there, you'll have the opportunity of, you know, calling into a voicemail box, leaving your question. It's all perfectly confidential, or emailing your question in, and then Joyce will be able to answer that on air and help you. I wonder if we could just take a look at, you'd sent me a bookmark, and it kind of talks about some of the, I liked it because it looked at what kind of questioning process you go through. You're very big on questions. Yeah. I wonder if you can talk about that a little.
Well, I created that bookmark out of, you know, doing hundreds of workshops and working with lots of clients, because often it was like, okay, now tell me where I should start first. And, you know, of course there's a place to start, and I believe that one of the things to, that one must do is to really ask themselves, who am I? You know, and if they know the answer to that question, great. But if not, then I encourage to live in that question. You know, who am I? Who am I really? You ask a small child, and they might tell you, you know, I'm an artist, I'm a dreamer, I'm a poet. But often adults get a little bit stymied, shall I say. Like, oh my gosh, that's a big question. So I think that's one of the very first places to start.
Yeah, we get stuck in our ways of thinking and being. I mean, it's quite understandable. We're all busy, and sometimes we just need that little prod to start thinking outside. Mm-hmm. You say that we all have an inner knowing on your bookmark here. We all have an inner knowing. How do you know when your inner knowing is speaking to you?
I think that the main part is that you really have to start listening to that and to, you know, really embrace that there is a natural knowingness in all of us. I believe that we can all be our own coach, and it may take some time, and it may take some guidance to get there, to trust and know ourselves well enough to do this. So it's like, start listening. You know, the day-to-day living, the activities, even the weather can take us out of, you know, who we are and what we want to do. So it's like, okay, start to listen.
Right.
And that may sound so simple, but, you know, start to listen. I've had people laugh and say, yes, that's where you can start. Start to listen.
Yeah, big thing. That's what I'm doing right now.
Oh, good.
You say we need to define our dreams. Some of the questions to get people started are, you know, what are you here to do? What makes your heart sing? What's the greatest you can be? Form a vivid picture of your dream. Put it down in words. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, one is, along with the listening to ourselves, is to just really get clear about, okay, this is what I want my life to be about. This is what I want to do. This is what I want to realize. And, you know, it sounds a little esoteric, but this is the mark I want to live, and this is the mark I want to leave. So it's like, okay, well, what are you here to do? That's, you know, how many words? 6 words, but a huge question. You know, what am I here to do? And it's also, I call it delicious, a delicious way to live. It's like, okay, this is what I'm here to do. Sure, there'll be food to buy and laundry to do and work to be done and phone calls to be returned, but right. What am I really here to do?
Okay. Well, we're at the end of our show right now, Joyce, so that's a good place for us to break on there. We'll be back with you the third Monday of next month, and meanwhile, listeners can call in to me, my voicemail, I'll give that out in a minute, or email with a question that you would like to get answered. We'll be back next week. You can reach me at info@conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net, or 800-495-7617. See you next week. Live well, live strong.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, former editor-in-chief of Shape Magazine, tells how she went from being a highly successful businesswoman living her dream to losing it all and living her worst nightmare, a Bernie Madoff victim. Alexandra Penny recounts her struggle to overcome complete financial collapse. Now back on top, she'll share her journey in the Bag Lady Papers, the priceless experience of losing it all. See conversationslive.net for more information.